Very privileged this evening to have John Temple with us. John has been preaching for over 40 years, and he has he's currently preaching for the Scottsboro congregation. And I was looking, he has invited me to speak at Scottsboro more than I've been invited to speak anywhere, and he said we wouldn't be friends anymore if I didn't invite him to Pleasant View. He didn't say that, but no, he is a good friend of mine, and I'm thankful for his years of preaching and him as a person, his humility, and how much he cares about people. And hopefully this week we've noticed that everyone has a story to tell. And you think, well, no, I really don't. Well, you do. You have a story to tell about where you've been and where you are now and where you want to go. And it may not seem dramatic to you, maybe as dramatic as the lessons that we've heard this week, but nonetheless, somebody may hear that and say, that's interesting, that's compelling, and I want to do what you're doing. I want to have the things or the peace and the blessings that you have. And you may be able to convert someone simply by telling them some of your story. And Brother Temple's done that for years. His story is unique in many ways, and I know you'll be inspired by it this evening. He'll stand on the floor and may need to sit down, and that'll be fine, but so thankful to have Brother John Temple with us tonight.
Let me see, is this working? Okay. I get my sermon leader at Scottsboro to stand before I speak always because I get so stiff I can't stand up. I was given a number of minutes to speak to you, and I thought, I don't know if I'm staying that long. But so he brought this chair. I probably won't use it, but you never know. I use a stool to teach all my classes at Scottsboro. After 20 years of doing that, they're used to me doing that. I noticed my song leader on singing night sat down. So I've left an impression even on the members at Scottsboro. We have had over the last several years a number of orthopedic problems, and I've always said you're following the bad example of your preacher who's had all these orthopedic problems. But it is such a joy to be with you ever since Brother James invited me. I've looked forward to this, and I have been in a number of places telling my story, and I really feel like Paul felt uncomfortable boasting about all the things he'd been through for the Lord. I really don't like to tell my story. There's so many other stories, and I appreciate Brother James saying, you know, my story is not the only one. A lot of you, your story our story might not be as dramatic as others, but everybody lives goes through difficulty. And if you come through that difficulty with faith and you come through that difficulty with courage and conviction, then you've got a story to tell and you can help somebody else. I've always said, you know, I'm not a good person to sit down with someone who's lost their spouse and say, I understand, because I don't. I've not lost my spouse. I haven't been through that experience. So there are a number of experiences that others are much better suited for helping others than I am. But I appreciate the invitation to come and share my story with you. It started actually 38 years ago. I was 25 years old. I came back from Georgia. I've been preaching at a mission point in Georgia. I came back at the wrong time. We've had this recession for a good time now, and it's hard to find a job. Well, the recession of 1974 was when I came back from Georgia to Nashville. Not a good time. So I found a job, a temporary job, where I was going to hopefully get a better job in the spring. Kept that job about 3 months. It was a job working at a store called Stop and Go. It's one of those Matco type places, one of those places where you just have a store that's open all the time, 24 hours a day. And I was the night manager. I was 11 o'clock at night to 7 o'clock the next morning. And so it was a boring job because after about 12 o'clock, now this is 38 years ago, I know now you can go to Walmart at all times of the night. I went to Walmart one time at 12 o'clock. I don't remember what I did for it. And I saw Jerry Barber there. I said, what are you doing up this late? And he said, what are you doing up this late? So people stay up a lot later than they used to, apparently. I know I don't, but some people do. But we were open all night long, but by 12 o'clock, all the customers had cleared out, and especially on a Saturday night, because on Saturday nights, you know, people are just, we're staying in more, it seemed. But I worked a boring job from 11 o'clock at night to 7 the next morning. Actually, during the night, I got so bored that I would mop floors and wax floors and fill coolers and do everything I could do to try to stay, you know, to make it pass faster. Well, this particular night that I'm talking about was February the 16th, 1975. I'd been working at the store for some time. I had one occasion where a man walked in the store and I heard, "Stick 'em up," and I thought, uh-oh. And there's a guy holding his hand like this and toward me, and he said, "What would you have done if this had been a real stick-up?" I said, "I'd have given you the money in the register and under the register. Anything you wanted, I'd have brought it, taken it out to your car for you if you wanted me to." I had consigned in my mouth, in my mind, that whatever it took, I was just going to do whatever the person who robbed the store, if they did, robbed the store would want. We weren't allowed to have guns or anything or any protection, so we just depended on the Metro Police for that. But the reality is that it actually happened about 2 weeks after this, that I had a normal night, a typical night. It was another boring night. I mopped and waxed the floors and did all kinds of things. So 3 o'clock in the morning. 3 o'clock in the morning, there were two guys that walked in my store, and I looked up and saw them, and it made me a little nervous because I'm not used to people that on a Saturday, actually a Sunday morning at 3 o'clock coming in the store. So they talked to me for a while and sat on the cooler and drank a Coke, and they said they were going to, this is by the way at Tusculum Stop and Go. It was located just off Nolensville Road, so it's right there in Nashville. And these two guys talked to me for about 30 minutes and made me a little nervous, but I said, "You're going to have to go on because I've got work to do in the back." And so they did. And when I walked outside, I noticed they were gone. I mean, I looked up and they were just gone, which made me a little nervous anyway. Well, about an hour and a half later, at 5 o'clock in the morning, the doorbell rang again, which told me, and I worked by myself. I was the night manager, the only person in the store. And all of a sudden the doorbell rang and I went behind the counter and a man walks up. It's a normal looking customer, a young man about 20 years old. He was wearing, I know what he's wearing even today, this blue jean type coat with blue jean pants and a yellow shirt. Just a young guy, about 5'7", something like that, because I had to kind of look down a little bit. I'm 6'1". And he walked in the store and he asked for, unfortunately we sold cigarettes, he asked for cigarettes, so I turned around and got him. When I came back around to give it to him, he came out from under his coat with a sawed-off 16-gauge shotgun and pointed it right at my head. He said, "You give me all the money in that register, and even under the change." Apparently, he knew that we kept money. Now, my job as an employee was to, anything over $45, I was to put in a drop box. And it was a concrete vault that I usually didn't have the key to, but that night the key was sitting right on the top of it. And I was wondering why the manager, day manager, did that, but it was there. And so he asked me for the money. All I had was $45 because I'd done a good job of dropping everything else in a drop box. So I tried to hand it to him, and I tried, by the way, if he'd asked for that money, I'd have just turned over there and unlocked that lock. And I was told later by the day manager, he said, "You know, I forgot to take the week's money in there and deposit it." There were $3,000 in the drop box, but he didn't ask for that, so I didn't give it to him, and I didn't even know $3,000 were in there. So I put the money on the counter like he said. He said, "Lay down on the floor." Now, I'm always apprehensive, you know, what do you do? And I told you my plan was to do whatever you said. So I lay down on the floor, and I got real comfortable and laid on my chin like that, and I laid on a concrete floor that had a little carpet underneath me. And that I lay as far under as I could get, and that box was sitting there, which probably saved my life. All of a sudden, I heard a gunshot blast. And I thought at first this guy shot over my head to make sure I didn't get up, but I wasn't about to get up. I, you know, let him go. I didn't want to even anyway try to stop him. But what had happened was he leaned over the counter. It was a pretty good-sized counter, and put it a foot from my back and pulled the trigger. And he left me to die on the floor. At about 5:15 on Sunday morning. The next person that would probably come in the store would probably be the day manager, which would be an hour and a half later, and I probably would be dead. The doctor said I was probably knocked unconscious for at least a half an hour. And so I didn't even realize that I was shot. But I remember my ears ringing, and I remember hearing the shot, and I remember thinking, I'm going to give him a little more time, and then I'm going to get up and look over the counter and see if he's gone. The doctors don't know how I did what I did next. I decided to pick myself up and look over the counter. I know that I got as high as the cash register because when I looked back and saw that my legs were not moving, I pulled all the coins, the quarters and the dimes, I pulled all them onto the floor. I don't know why I pulled them down there, but I just thought maybe I can. I had two phones in there. One was a phone on the wall, which was a coin-operated one. One was up pretty high that was behind me that was the store's phone. And I remember thinking, my first thought, I've got to call someone. But I thought that I can't reach that phone, and I sure can't crawl across the store and use the pay phone. So I'm going to have to wait for somebody to come in the store. So I just began to say what I thought were my last prayers. I really did. I'm thinking I'm 25 years old. I've got a little girl. She is 14 months old. She's blonde-haired, blue-eyed, beautiful little girl. And I've been married for about 3 years, and I thought at 25, I never would have guessed that I would die at 25. As I looked under my arm, as I lay down just like I had done before, I could see my blood going across the floor. And I thought, I don't want to see that. I don't want to watch myself die. So I began to pray, God, help me to go unconscious so that I won't have to watch myself die. And about that time, you know, you remember Garth Brooks' song, Thank God for Unanswered Prayers? Well, I think God answers in three ways. He says yes or no or later. But I'm glad he didn't hear that prayer I was praying for, because the next thing I heard was the bell on the door ring, which meant somebody had entered the store. My first thought was, this guy's coming back to see that I was dead and maybe even get more money if he could get it. I don't know what. But I said, I've got to take a chance. That's what I was thinking. I've got to take a chance. So I hollered, call an ambulance. And I heard a voice, and I'm still face down. And I heard a voice, and he said, where are you? And I could hear him walking behind me. He said, you just lay there, and I wasn't going anywhere. You just lay there, and I'll call an ambulance, is what he said. And I thought, this guy's going to get over there, and he's going to say, where is that quarter? And I said, there's some quarters on the floor over here if you need them. Even in that, I found a sense of humor. I don't know how, but I found a sense of humor. I could hear him put the coin in, and I could hear him call. The first people that got there were the policemen. By the way, this guy that came in the store, I never saw him until about 2 weeks later. 2 weeks later, I was in the hospital laying flat on my back, paralyzed, my chest down. And a guy came to my door of my room. I was in a private room at that time. And he said, you might not remember me. He said, I'm the guy that called the ambulance. I said, you were. And I couldn't shake his hand hard enough. But the guy that came in, and literally God used this guy to come in and save my life. He told me a story. He said, let me tell you something that's kind of strange. He said, I'm never going to that store. I work a night shift too. I was coming home from, and he says, I walked to the front door and I don't even know why I was going in the store. He said, I turned around when I didn't see anybody and started to walk out when I heard a voice say, call an ambulance. He said, if you had not said anything, I'd have walked out the store thinking you were in the back working. And he said, I don't really know why I went in that store. Well, I don't know why he went in that store either, but I see God's hand in that. I think God does a lot of things that are inexplainable. And there's no explanation for that guy to be even in the store, let alone stay there, or let me be alert enough to holler, call an ambulance if God's hand was not in that. Several people have told me God must have saved you for a reason. And I believe he has. And I've tried to fulfill that mission of trying to help other people know the truth ever since then. But this guy, the first persons that came were the policemen. The policemen came and they were behind me, and again, I didn't see them. I was face down. And they began to ask me all kind of questions and about numbers and what the people looked like that shot me and all that. And I gave them a description, you know, the blue jean coat and the pants and the yellow shirt. And then he started asking questions about my family and what's their number. And I thought, he thinks I'm going to die. So it scared me. And so I asked him, I said, am I going to die? He said, oh, son, you're doing just fine. You're going to be doing just fine. Well, this officer's name is Officer Pickle. You can't forget a name like that, can you? Officer Pickle. Well, 2 years later, Officer Pickle was shot in that same store. And what happened was, a guy came in the middle of the day, completely not related to my incident at all, but he is related, Officer Pickle is. And he came with a bulletproof vest. He heard that the store was being robbed by a guy with a high-powered rifle, like a .44, it's real high-powered. And he heard he was being robbed, and he came and looked through the window. When he did, this guy just dropped that big rifle and shot through the window. It went into his bulletproof vest all the way through it, splintered his spleen, left him laying out on the sidewalk. The guy walks out on the sidewalk and is going to shoot the policeman again when his partner comes over the hill with a riot gun. Riot gun only has about 5 pellets, but they're about that big around. He just fired at the guy. Well, he killed it. And they pulled his mask off, and it was an 18-year-old kid. And his dad said, I don't know what he was doing in that store. I had no clue. And he only hit him with one of those shots, and it went right between his eyes. But that was not the guy that shot me. But Officer Pickle is interesting, because I told when I found out it was Officer Pickle that was shot, I got permission to go see him in the hospital. And I walked up to him and asked him how he was doing, of course, and he was doing fine. They had to remove his spleen and so forth. But I asked him, I said, what did you think when I asked you that question, am I going to die? I said, first of all, do you remember me? And he said, oh, yes, I remember you. I said, what did you think? He said, when I walked up on you, your shirt was completely shot off your back. You didn't have a shirt anymore. And there was 360 pellets that went into my back. And he said, I didn't think you had a prayer. But I just didn't have the nerve to tell you, son, I think you're going to die. And so the next thing that came in were the medics. When the medics came in, I felt them cutting my clothes off, and they were putting a patch on my back, and they were putting an IV in and doing all that while I was laying face down. Then the medics did something they won't do today. They turned me over. Now, you don't turn someone who's got a spinal injury. We know that now, but they turned me over. Up to this point, I had not felt a lot of pain, but I started feeling pain then. When they turned me over, I started hurting for the first time. I see some faces that I've never seen but heard their voices. And the medic said, which hospital do you want to go to? I said, the closest one. Thankfully, the closest one was the best one. It was General Hospital. And General Hospital today, of course, is not nearly the hospital it was then. Back then, that was the trauma place. That was where all the Metro policemen went. That's where they had a great trauma unit. All the Vanderbilt doctors went to General Hospital. They were the doctors. My neurosurgeon was a Vanderbilt doctor. So they had the best doctors for our Metro policemen and others that were connected with Metro. So I went to the right hospital. I remember that ride, though, that ambulance ride, when they put me in the ambulance. And I remember every corner screaming to the top of my lungs, to the point that the man that was working on me in the back of the ambulance hollered up to the guy who was driving and said, you're going to have to slow down on the corners. And of course, I was laying on my back. When I started going under the overhang of General Hospital, I remember thinking, if I can just get to the hospital, I think I might live. When I got in the hospital, they waited 3.5 to 4 hours before they did any surgery on me at all. They didn't think I was going to live. And so there's no sense working on me. I mean, a man that has 360 shots going his back from a sawed-off 16 shotgun 1 foot away from his back, not likely to live. And so they just waited. They just put dye through my body in order to see how many leaks I had, how many arteries were shot up. Of 360 pellets that went into my back, not one hit a major artery. Not one hit any of my organs. And the chances of that happening are just about zero, and maybe you have to give it 1%. But it just, and the doctors were just shocked that I didn't have internal bleeding. All my blood came from external bleeding. And so they operated on me, and I remember waking up in intensive care. And I remember a doctor walking over to me, and I'm thinking I'm shot with a single bullet. I didn't know I was shot with a shotgun. So the doctor walks over and he says, Mr. Temple, he says, you've been shot and you're paralyzed from your chest down. And I remember them doctors testing me. They would put sharp pointed things in my feet. Nothing. No reaction at all. I was totally paralyzed from my chest down. And I remember them telling me, it doesn't look good. I had all kinds of things to happen in the hospital. I remember I was in intensive care only for about a week. I was supposed to have been in there, 2 or 3 weeks. But I remember intensive care was different than it is today. Just a curtain separated people, patients. And so there was a woman next to me. They're trying to get her to swallow a tube, and she was gagging on it, and it was just making me sick. And then there was a guy over here just fell out of a tree. He fell 80 foot out of a tree and hit every limb coming down and broke every bone in his body. And he had a cast on his arms and his legs and his neck and his head. And he would sit there all day long banging those, he was just out of his mind, banging those casts on the side of his bed. And it made me so nervous that the doctor said, I think you'd be better off in a room, a private room. And so they put me in a private room. I've been in a hospital for about 7 weeks and went home early at that. During that period of time, I got a blood clot in my left leg and I had almost died from that. My mother was the one that noticed and recognized the blood clot and told the doctors, and they started treating me with a blood thinner, and I had an allergic reaction to the blood thinner, so they had to try something else. So the setbacks were there. I remember the first time they tried to pick me up, I laid in all flat on my back, and when they tried to put me on a board, and this board would gradually lean me up. Well, after 3 weeks of laying flat on my back, not only did all of my muscles deteriorate, when I went to the hospital, I could bench press 250 pounds. Well, they gave me a 5-pound weight, and I could only put it up one time. That's all I could do. And so every muscle in my body, just because they weren't using them and because of the paralysis, they just went to nothing. But I remember they came in and they put me up on that board, and I was just screaming, but let me back down, because I was falling out. I knew I was going to faint, and I did. I fell out. And they put me back in bed. And they would set me up in a wheelchair and try to get me used to setting up and that sort of thing eventually. They came in one day to physical therapy. They had physical therapy every day. They'd come in and move my legs, even if I couldn't. And I remember they came in and I said, what's that? And they said, leg braces. And I said, what are you going to do? And they said, our goal for you is this. We want you eventually to have arm crutches, and we'll put these braces on your legs so that your legs will be straight. And you swing yourself. Swing yourself. And I said, no. And they said, what? I said, no. I said, you give me a year, and if I'm not better in a year, then you can put those braces on my legs. And so they said, okay. Okay, we'll do something else. I never wore those braces. Never put those braces on. Now, I had physical therapy for years after this. Matter of fact, when I went home after 7 weeks, they said, only way you can go home is if you come back every day and take physical therapy. And I had a nurse that would get me in my wheelchair and put me in a cab and take me all the way to General Hospital, then bring me back and get me back in the house. I had a nurse that did that for me. And physical therapy was hard work. Just getting myself, it took four of them to get me straight up the first time, just to let stand. I was just so weak I couldn't hold myself up. And I remember going home the day I went home. I told the nurse, I said, I'm going home Monday. She said, well, sure you are. And I did. I went home the next Monday. And even I think the nurses were surprised that I would go home so quickly. But I remember when I got home how hard it was. They put a trapeze over my bed. My wife, Donna, had to quit her job. We had to move in with my parents and stay in their home. And my wife took care of me and nursed me for years, taking care of me. In the middle of the night, I'd get these real hard muscles, even though you've heard of people who've lost limbs, who have phantom pains. Somebody lost a foot, and they said, my foot's hurting. Well, I had those. I had pains, and I had these cramps that would get in my legs. And if she didn't get them out, then they'd go into Charlie horses. Anybody have a Charlie horse? Hurts, doesn't it? If you don't get that thing out or get that thing working, you're in trouble. So my wife would get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and grab my foot and push it back and get my leg straightened out so that I wouldn't go into a Charlie horse. And she had to do that 2 or 3 times a night. And I had not only muscle spasms, but I had all kinds of other issues and problems. Greatly depressed when I went home because I used to be able to do so much, now I can't do anything. And that depressed me greatly. I remember thinking when I got home, though, I'm going to have to really change my mind about some things. The guy that shot me, there's a guy that wrote, there were people that kept trying to write about me, and I brought some, by the way, some different articles as well as some x-rays of my back that were taken years ago, if you'd like to see them afterwards. But I remember, they wrote in one of the papers, John Temple, who lives at 428 Mercomatic Drive, is afraid that the guy that shot him might come back and shoot him. My mother didn't tell me that until I got later. Told in the paper where I lived, and that I was afraid the guy might shoot me. That just shows you how ignorant some people can be. But anyway, those articles are interesting. This guy that shot me went 12 hours later, and he killed a man in Colombia. The same wadding of the gun and everything, so it was the same guy. People always ask me about this guy, and I'll go ahead and mention him. He died when he was 22 years old. He overdosed on some bad heroin. And I was called to the hospital. One of our elders at West Nashville Heights died, and so I went to the general hospital. And it's years after, of course, I was shot. And I saw the detective, my detective that was working my case. And he said, did you hear that the guy that shot you is dead? And I said, no. I said, why didn't you call me to come and identify him? He says, because you couldn't. He said, the guy was 22 years old. He looked like a 60-year-old man. And I thought, that's horrible. Horrible. He shot me for drugs. He got $45. He got $50 from the guy that was on the service station floor. Shot him in the back of the head. Had I not crawled under the counter like I did with that drop vault right beside my head, he would have shot me right through the back of my head. So this guy's, unfortunately, has expired. It's interesting, isn't it? All these things that I've mentioned about how things happen. And let me tell you, before I was shot, I used to love sports. I could run the 100-yard dash in 10 flat. Now, that's not world-class speed, but that's not slow. Could dunk a basketball. Before I was shot, I could do just about anything I wanted to do. And then when I was shot, I went home in a wheelchair with a ramp built out in front of my house. And I remember praying. I wheeled myself down that ramp by myself one time and was going down my driveway. And I remember running down my driveway. And I asked God, just let me walk down this driveway. And he not only let me walk down the driveway, he let me run. I reached the point where I could actually play half-court basketball. Couldn't dunk it. Couldn't run fast. But I could play basketball. And I did that for about 25 years. Until recently when I've had other issues. I've had two heart attacks. The last one I had open heart surgery. Two of my blockages were on the left descending anterior artery, which is the widowmaker. 98% blockages on two widowmakers. That's close. And so I had open heart surgery. Then 2 years, 4 years later, I had a defibrillator implanted. So I've had knee surgery from falling. I've had shoulder surgery from falling. I've had hand surgery from falling. And I fractured my hip socket playing basketball. But if I'm going to get injured, at least let me do something that I enjoy doing. So I did get a lot of things back. And in recent years, the last 2 years, I've gone down and I'm losing motion in my left side, which I thought might happen. So I've as long as I was able to, I did a lot of things that God gave me the ability and to be able to do. Now I have to use my cane. I can't walk without it. And probably will end up within a year or two having to use two canes. And then eventually, if I keep going down, I'll have to be back in the wheelchair. But I don't say that with sadness, because God gave me so many good years. It's hard for me to be upset about what's happening now. I found out, as a matter of fact, that it doesn't matter. Life is like that. You have good years, but sometimes you have setbacks. And I'm used to setbacks. And God has blessed me greatly. Well, how did I cope with being shot? That's my main message for tonight. Some of you might be wondering, how do you cope with that? Well, how'd you deal with a guy that shot you? Well, let me tell you what I did with him. I forgave him. I went to the Tennessee State Prison, hobbled in there, and I talked for almost 3 years to people that were just like the one that shot me. And they didn't know, understand why I was there. And I've got some articles even from the Interim, which is the prison paper written by a prisoner, asking the question, why are you here? I tell you what, I used to think that forgiving other people, like the Lord said to forgive them, was something you did for them. you're giving them a break. The reality was I was doing something for me. And God knows that. And when you forgive people that don't deserve to be forgiven, you're actually releasing yourself. Because when I forgave him, actually forgave him, it freed me. I no longer was afraid of him. Didn't matter if he came in my house. I'm in a bed, paralyzed, didn't matter. Didn't matter at all. Whatever happened, God's going to be with me. And God's going to bless me. So, in dealing with him, the best thing you can do with your enemies, the people that don't like you, the people that shoot you, that don't even know you, is to forgive them. Offer that forgiveness. Because it's the best thing you'll ever do for yourself. It really is. Another thing I want to point out is the fact of the matter is, in order to cope with this, my faith in God was so important. I don't know what I'd done if I hadn't had faith in God. I just don't. It just seems like my faith in God just led me through the whole thing. God didn't promise me to walk in my driveway, but he let me do it, for which I have thanked him many times. There was a man at General Hospital the same time I was, and my doctor came in, my neurosurgeon came in, and he said, "There's a guy up on the third floor that just died. He had the same thing that you've got." And I said, "Well, thank you." I needed to hear that. No, he said he shouldn't have died. I said, "What do you mean?" He said he gave up. He didn't have anything to live for. So he gave up. And his message to me was, "Don't you give up." But he didn't really have to tell me that. I'm glad he did. But he didn't have to tell me that. My faith in God won't let me give up. As long as God gives me breath, I want to live. By the way, a nurse came in one day and she said, "I'm the doctor who operated on you's nurse. I've never seen her before." She said, "You probably don't remember me, but I remember you. I assisted the doctor when he worked on you." She said, "You were a real good patient." I said, "Yeah, I laid there real good, didn't I?" She said, "We can tell people who really want to live from people who don't. We can tell from the vital signs. We can tell from all kinds of things." And she said, "I can tell that you have a desire to live. And you have a reason to live, something to live for." My faith in God, supreme. That's the first thing. If you don't have that, you're in trouble. You're really in trouble. The other thing is support of my personal family. I've been married for almost 41 years now. Actually, over 41 years. My wife would correct me. 41 years. With a lady that decided, you know, some people, when they run into that situation, my husband, I know it's for better or for worse, but didn't know it was going to be this bad. She could have left me. She could have said, "I don't want to be married to a paraplegic. I don't want to have to be nurse for him the rest of his life. He's 25. How long? A long time to take care of somebody." She didn't. She stayed right beside me. And my family really is important to me. You think I don't appreciate her today for what she did and what she continues to do? I think about my daughter, my little 14-month-old daughter. She's now 39. And I have a granddaughter that just graduated from Good Pasture Christian. God has let me live so long. When I was in the hospital, I had... let me mention one more thing first. My personal family is important to me. When you've got God and you've got a personal family to lean on, it means a lot. I had 500 cards while I was in the hospital. And I look back and I still have most of those cards. I still have them. I kept them. 38 years. And I look back at the names of those people who sent me wishes, and there were sometimes little children that I didn't even know that said, "We're praying for you and we want you to get better." Don't you know that helped me a lot? A little child that doesn't even know you're praying for you. And I had all these people. I noticed that West Nashville Heights, a lot of people sent me cards. And ironically, they have died. Most of those people that sent me cards were the elderly. The elderly are real good at sending cards. But I got cards every day. Somebody said, "You get cards every day. We got people up there that never get a card." I felt so blessed to have a Christian family that will send me cards. And every day tell me, "I'm praying for you." Reminds me of this short poem that I put in our bulletin a few years ago. I said a prayer for you today. I said a prayer for you today and know God must have heard. I felt the answer in my heart, although he spoke not a word. I didn't ask for wealth or fame. I knew you wouldn't mind. I ask him to send treasures for a far more lasting kind. I ask to be near, ask that he be near you at the start of each day, to grant you health and blessings and friends to share your way. I ask for happiness for you in all things, both great and small. But it was for his love and care I prayed for most of all. I said a prayer for you today. I have so many prayers. I couldn't have gone through it without prayers. I couldn't have done that. Let me say also, I'm thankful for what I have rather than what I don't have. You can sit around and think about what you don't have all day, and you can count your many obstacles, or you can count your many blessings. That's why it doesn't bother me that I'm losing some of my health and I'm going through some times that are difficult, because I have been so blessed, so blessed, that I just have nothing to complain about. And that's why I like this poem. Now, you've probably heard it before, but it's one of my favorite. I found it years ago. Today up on a bus, I saw a lovely girl with silken hair. I envied her. She seemed so happy. I wished I were so fair. Then suddenly she rose to leave. I saw her hobble down the aisle. Oh, God, forgive me when I whine. I have two legs. The world is mine. And then I stopped to buy some sweets. The lad who sold them had such charm. I talked with him. He seemed so calm, as if I were late would do no harm. As I left, he said to me, I thank you. You've been so kind. It's nice to talk to folks like you. You see, I'm blind. Oh, God, forgive me when I whine. I have two eyes. The world is mine. Later, walking down the street, I saw a child with eyes of blue. He stood and watched the others play. It seemed he knew not what to do. I stopped a moment and said, why don't you join the others, dear? He looked ahead without a word, and then I knew he couldn't hear. Oh, God, forgive me when I whine. I have two ears. The world is mine. With legs to take me where I go, with eyes to see the sunset's glow, with ears to hear what I need to know. Oh, God, forgive me when I whine. I am blessed indeed. The world is mine. I like that. I have been able in coping to focus on what I have, not on what I don't have. Let me say finally, one of the things that I don't say very lightly that has caused me to rethink difficulties in your life, I would go through what I have gone through all over again, if for nothing else than the good things that have come from it. When I was shot, my parents were not in church. My three sisters were not in church. They're all members. They weren't attending. Because of what happened to me, my parents went back to church. My sisters went back to church. My dad became an elder in the church and was an elder for 20 years before he died. My mother became a teacher, a Bible school teacher, and she quit smoking and she quit doing a lot of things in order to do that. And I see my three sisters, all three today are faithful members of the church, all related to me. I had an uncle that was an atheist. He was an atheist, and I only had one uncle. And he's always cutting up and joking. And he came to see me when I went home from the hospital, and he said, there's got to be a God for you to live through what you've gone through. And he became a faithful member of the church. I don't know how many good things have come from my hardship, but I would go through all that again, and I'll say that lightly, for the good that has come. God can take things that are difficult and bring good things out of it. And he's done that with my life. Tonight I've talked a lot about me, and again I apologize for using me as an illustration. There are other better people, and you've already heard all week various people that are just I love dearly. Sellers Crane came to see me when I was in the hospital and paralyzed, and he came every day. So you've been talking to some people, or heard some people this week that had an impact on my life. And so I just commend you for selecting those men. Of course, Brother John last night, just some great people on that list. I appreciate you inviting me to be with those people. As an invitation, let me suggest to you that God always is a God of second chances. You don't know, and I don't know what tomorrow holds. But what we do know is if we're holding His hand and He's holding ours. You can know that. I only have today. You only have today. My life changed overnight. More than one time. And some of you have had those experiences too. I'm thankful we serve the God of second chances. God, Peter said this way, God is not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. All should come to repentance. And we know that God loves us because He sent His Son to die on the cross. Tonight is an opportunity. An opportunity. Do you need to take advantage of it? We're going to sing a song of encouragement. If you're not a child of God, then hopefully you will see the need to make the right steps and make Jesus the Lord of your life. If you come believing in Jesus as the Son of God, if you come penitently, humbly admitting you're a sinner and you can't save yourself, if you come confessing that Jesus is Christ and Lord, if you come being baptized to wash away your sins, then you can be a child of God. I was a child of God when I was shot. Don't know what would have happened if I hadn't have been. I do know what happened because I was. It made a difference. If you're a child of God and you stand in need of prayer, then we serve a God that wants us to talk to Him. And I'm sure we'd have individuals here who would go to our Heavenly Father in your behalf. If you need to respond, do it now as we stand and as we sing.